Good afternoon. I would like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 27th. Let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. I think Mr. Skidmore is the one who owes us donuts, but he's not. He's conveniently not here today. I suppose we'll give him a pass. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records, Talia Ames with the Juno LIO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will bring back House Bill 67, Harassment, Sex Offenders, and Offenses from the Governor as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in second hearing. Our legislative legal is working on the committee substitute for House Bill 68. As was noticed, but we are going to be working on 67 today since it is not ready. It is a big change. So we will take up House Bill 67 on harassment and have the Department of Law and Public Safety online to help answer questions. It is my intent today that the committee focus on the sex offense and sex offender registry portions of the bill since we did not get to take a dive into that previously. I'd like to let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Eastman. Welcome. So if we could welcome Ms. Casey Schroeder to the table. Oh, I apologize. Mr. Skidmore is available over the telephone, I believe. Mr. Skidmore, can you hear us?
I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am. I can hear you. Good afternoon. This is John Skidmore from the Department of Law. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And did you want me to just go ahead and jump in presenting, Madam Chair?
Why don't you just give everyone an overview since it has been a short time since we have heard this bill, and then we can begin with questions.
This bill, HB 67, that's in front of you, covers five main areas. The first involves the ability to summarize information in grand jury. I believe that was what we had talked about significantly at the last hearing. The other four provisions of the bill deal with the sex offender registry in two ways. First, it allows out-of-state sex offenders requires out-of-state sex offenders to register in Alaska if they have to register from the state from which they came. That's a provision that's currently in law for any offenses that occurred after 2019. This bill would also apply to offenses prior to 2019. In addition, the bill also requires some additional elements for sex offender registry. Those are found in Section 4, pages 4 and 5 of the bill. These are additional requirements that make it the sex offender registry more in line with both what the federal government requires and what other states require. It requires things such as a full name as opposed to just a name, a physical and mailing address as opposed to just an address, that sort of information. And there's a more detailed and complete description, as I indicated, on pages 4 and 5. The last three things that the bill then does is that it addresses stalking in the first degree. Stalking in the first degree is when there is unwanted conduct and there is already a protective order for domestic violence at the time of that stalking behavior. What this bill would do is that it would add protective orders for stalking itself and sexual assault to those same concepts, so that if there is a protective order for any of those three, the conduct would be treated the same as stalking in the first degree. The fourth thing that the bill does is it provides authority for child advocacy centers to provide assessments and then making recommendations for children that are under the age of 13 that engage in sex acts with one another. And then last but not least, the bill also addresses violation of conditions release It ensures that when there are multiple violations of conditions of release resulting in from different days, that those violations are sentenced at least partially consecutively. That's a quick summary of the bill, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you for that update. I'd like to look at the record reflect. We were joined by Representative Allard, Co-Chair Allard, Vice Chair Allard. We have lots of chairs. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Deputy Attorney General Skidmore, would you, I'd like to talk about Section 2 regarding the crime of stalking as you described. And since we've been working on sex trafficking, does any of this provision apply to people who have been trafficked as the bill is written?
To the chair, the protective orders are for domestic violence, protective orders for stalking, and protective orders for sexual assault. So if you had an individual who was a victim of sex or human trafficking that had applied for one of those three types of protective orders, yes, it would apply to them. If they had not applied for that type of protective order, then the stalking provisions in the first degree don't apply. It would just be stalking provisions in the second degree, which is not part of the bill, that could also apply to them.
In your opinion, do you think that a person who has been a victim of sex trafficking would naturally fall into the sexual assault area of the bill, or would we need to specifically identify that?
To the chair, the protective order for sexual assault is when someone indicates that they have been sexually assaulted. There are certainly victims of sex trafficking that could qualify for that type of a protective order, but I don't know that all of them would. I am unfamiliar with any protective orders that are specifically designed for victims of sex trafficking. The only protective orders that I'm familiar with are the three that the bill addresses: domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking in and of itself.
Thank you. I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson. Deputy Attorney General Skidmore, you can imagine my concern as we've been hearing the testimony of different victims of sex trafficking and the concern of being sought after by their traffickers, where a protective order may appear appropriate. And that's why I'm asking this particular line of questions. But I do want to open it up to committee members for questions around these protective orders. Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. You know, just recalling some of the testimony we've received dealing with the violent nature of some of these sex trafficking operations, I just wanted to ask the question, what good will a protective order do to someone like that? I can see the risk that simply by filing the protective order, they might make themselves even more of a target if they've already been threatened with death or the death of family members and so forth. Will having a protective order do anything to help someone in that situation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you are accurate in that the filing of protective orders can at times make someone more of a target from someone that's attempting to abuse them. However, I would tell you that protective orders generally are beneficial in the sense that it does not require further violence from a victim, or against a victim, I should say, that instead the protective order prevents the person that would engage in that sort of violence from being anywhere near the victim. And so the protective order itself doesn't stop them, obviously, but the protective order does authorize law enforcement then to arrest someone or to bring charges against them, and it can protect them in the sense of preventing the abuser from either being in close proximity or from contact, either direct or indirect, with the victim. So there are things that the protective orders can do, but you are correct that the protective order in and of itself doesn't stop somebody from abusing somebody else. It just gives law enforcement more tools, hopefully, to prevent something from getting to that level of violence, if you can even stop the contact, whether in person or indirectly.
Follow up?
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious to know, what is the penalty for violating a protective order? And can you contrast that with penalty for being convicted of sex trafficking? I mean, if the penalty for sex trafficking isn't keeping someone from being a sex trafficker, how will the penalty for violating a protective order keep them from continuing to try and recruit the person into trafficking?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the protective orders themselves are considered to be Class A, the violation of protective orders are considered to be Class A misdemeanors. Stalking in the first degree is not simply a violation of the protective order, but also requires multiple attempts to contact the individual, and in the process of doing so, placing them in fear of further harm. When you have those multiple contacts, the violation of stalking in the first degree, I should say, which is stalking plus this, is a Class C felony. The Class C felony has a maximum penalty of 5 years and a first-time offense of 0 to 2. And so comparing that to penalties for sex trafficking in current law, the sex trafficking would certainly be higher. And the bill that is also in front of the committee, HB 68, the penalties would be increased more substantially in that bill. So there is a significant difference between the two. This particular provision was not introduced with the idea of trying to address sex trafficking. This particular provision was introduced with the idea of trying to treat victims of stalking or sexual assault who obtain protective orders to provide them the same sort of protections that are available to individuals that have protective orders for domestic violence. I understand the additional questions about sex trafficking, but candidly, this provision wasn't designed to address sex trafficking. This was designed to address those other types of protective orders.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And can you tell us, if we did extend the protective order to victims of sex trafficking, would the perpetrator or the person to whom the protective order is against, would that person need to have first been convicted of sex trafficking in order for that protective order to be effective?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's not a matter of expanding this to victims of sex trafficking. If they were to apply for a sexual assault, a stalking, or a domestic violence protective order, then they would be protected by that protective order. And there is not a requirement that the person previously be convicted. If you look at the bill on page 2, section 2, looking at lines 10 through 12, that's one version of stalking in the first degree. And that's the one that talks about the protective orders. The ones that talk about previous convictions is found down on lines 18 through 21 or 22 through 28. And in those instances, those are different subsections of stalking in the first degree. You'll note the or at the end of line 21 that says any one of these concepts is a basis. So it's not an and. So the short answer is no, you don't need a previous conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I see on line 15 of page 2, the victim is under 16 years of age. Can you tell us why that age, that particular age is listed in section number 2?
To the chair, that's a portion of the bill that is not changing anything. That age of 16 is what is currently in law. And at the time that this was there, the stalking in the first degree, you're talking about you don't have to have a protective order for someone under the age of 16. If someone under the age of 16 is a victim of stalking, that is that unwanted contact, that repeated unwanted contact, that's automatically a Class C felony. Why the legislature chose 16 in this particular provision, I can't tell you that, but that's what current law states.
When I see the age of 16, I automatically think of the age of consent, but I'm trying to justify in my mind why it wouldn't be age 18 when a person is a legal adult. That's why I asked the origin of that age, just to understand what legal justification there may be. I'm always questioning and wanting to make sure that we're protecting our children, even if they're 17 years of age, because it seems like our Alaskan youth are being subjected to so many different things. Definitely highlighted on my page. Do we have any further questions on Section 2 before we move on to any other areas of the bill? Great, let's move on to number 3, or Section 3. I'm just trying to be able to cover the bill thoroughly since we are getting trapped on time. There, Mr. Skidmore, if you could highlight on page 3, number 3, where two or more crimes of the violation is a condition of release. This is one of the larger changes on that. If you could highlight that for us one more time.
To the chair, section 3 of the bill, which is starting on the bottom of page 2 and continues then to page 3 of the bill, the amendment in this particular statute is found at the bottom of page 3, lines 24 through 27. This particular statute, 1255-127C, is the statute that addresses when sentences should run consecutively to one another as opposed to concurrently. And you can see that there are a number of other provisions that describe when that should occur. This is simply adding subsection 3, again, on lines 24 through 27, and it indicates when there are two or more crimes for a violation of conditions of release, and the 1156-757 is the statute that makes violation of conditions of release a crime in and of itself. It then requires a consecutive term of imprisonment to be imposed for some additional term of imprisonment. And as I've described previously, some additional term of imprisonment can be as little as one additional day.
Any questions for Mr. Skidmore on this section before we move? Wow, heavy lunch for everybody? Usually we have a whole litany of questions. Let's move on to section 4. This one I have lots of notes myself on, and on page 3, line 29, where it says a sex offender or child kidnapper required to register, and this is talking about the sex registry. If you want to cover this, or do you feel that DPS would better cover the section talking about the sex registry, Mr. Skidmore?
I'm happy to answer any questions that are there. What I would describe basically is that the requirements, the changes are predominantly found on lines 6 through 10 of page 4. These are adding additional details that are required to be provided to the registry. You can also find additional details on page 4, lines 24 and 25, and then get down to lines 29 and 30. And then finally on page 5, line 7 is also there. I believe Ms. Purrington is in the room from DPS, and she really manages the sex offender registry. So if there are questions about logistics, she's probably the best person for you all to turn to. If there are legal questions, then I'm happy to try and answer them.
Great. Before I get to logistics, Mr. Skidmore, we previously had a conversation with some of my questions that I'd like to ask on the record. A child kidnapper is currently required to register, and I asked you about if a human trafficker could be considered similar to a child trafficker, and if that would be a wise policy decision to add a human trafficker to this registry. Have you been able to follow up on an answer for me on that?
Madam Chair, I recall the conversation we had had. I was not anticipating that this bill was going to be in front of the committee today, so I have not gotten an answer to that question for you. What I would say is, in terms of a policy concept, the sex offender registry law applies to sex offenders and child kidnappers. Child kidnappers, in part because, I shouldn't say child kidnappers, it's just kidnapping, so it can be any kidnapper, even if the victim is an adult. So let me make that clear. So for kidnapping or sex offenses, is really where the registry is required. And for the kidnapping, there are several elements of kidnapping that relate to sex offenses themselves. I don't know if that's the rationale that was utilized when the law was implemented, or not, but expanding it to human traffickers is a policy call that the folks in the room could make, and it would be the question of, if somebody is engaged in labor trafficking, should they be on a registry like this or not? And that's squarely a policy call for folks there in the room. That's what I know about it, but I don't know if Ms. Purrington has any other details to add to that. I would, as I indicated, she's really an expert in this area, and so I would defer to her if she has anything else to add.
Before I invite her to the table, the other question that I had, just for clarification of the record, is that upon passage of the other bill, sex traffickers would be considered sex offenders and would be required to register. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Wonderful. So before we invite Ms. Burrington to the table, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I see there's different categories of offender that's required to register, and I'm just wondering, currently, do any of those offenders, are they required to provide the palm prints in addition to the fingerprints? I know on page 5, line 10, we're adding palm prints to that final portion of section 4. Is that currently required anywhere else, or is this brand new?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm going to defer to Ms. Purrington on that. Again, they're the ones that really run those sorts of things. It's not required in statute, but I'm not sure if there's another requirement that DPS has for that or not.
Thank you.
Ms. Purrington, would you be able to join us at the table? And I do apologize to, and thank Mr. Skidmore and Department of Law and Ms. Purrington for being available to discuss House Bill 67 on short notice. I was dreaming big on having a committee substitute, but I'm sure that everyone is working hard on that. So thank you for being available, Ms. Purrington. Please put your name for the record.
For the record, Lisa Purrington, Alaska Department of Public Safety. I'm the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief for the department. Through the chair to Representative Eastman's question regarding palm prints, the information that we're changing in this section of the bill is, as Mr. Skidmore indicated, is to align with the federal requirements. And so currently we do not require the palm prints. We require fingerprints at the time of arrest for the person that's being convicted. If the person has been convicted of a sex offense out of state, when they come to Alaska and register with the Sex Offender Registration Office, then we will again take a set of their fingerprints. But at this time, we're not taking the palm prints.
Follow up.
Thank you. Also through the chair. Now, why? What's the rationale, other than the feds do it, of course, what's the rationale for having palm prints, and why would we only be adding palm prints in this situation if it's a good idea? Why wouldn't we add palm prints every time someone's fingerprints are taken?
through the chair to Representative Eastman, it's a great question. We are continuously working on various biometric identification to be taken from offenders at the time of offense. Fingerprints has been the one we've been doing for quite some time to take the fingerprints. And as technology has been improving, they're also looking at, you know, taking the palm prints, because we have the technology that can actually capture those. If you'll recall, back in the day, most of your fingerprints were taken with the ink, and we were rolling the fingerprints, and so that was the technology we had at that time. And then we've transitioned to live scan devices where we're digitally taking those fingerprints, and now we also have that capacity to take the palm prints. And you're seeing, obviously, DNA was a big one that we've recently been adding. You know, and other states are also looking at, you know, iris images as well. So there's lots of biometrics that are being added to various data collection programs as that technology becomes available. And certainly, as, you know, Mr. Skidmore would like to say, it's a policy call. If we want to start collecting, you know, palm prints at the time of arrest, that's certainly something that we would have technology to do.
Hello.
Thanks. And the biometric data that we're being collected here, specifically the palm prints and I guess anything else that's added to that list, is that being collected from people before they've been convicted or after they've been convicted?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the information in this section is for people that have been convicted of a registrable sex offense.
Thank you.
Ms. Parenton, what's the advantage of having the palm versus the fingerprints? It just seems like the fingerprint would be a really good identifier. Is there an advantage to having the palm?
To the chair, great question. I couldn't answer that. I can certainly talk with our fingerprint examiners back at the office. You know, the first thing is just kind of some basic stuff, because sometimes you have people that have very poor quality fingerprint images, and it's very difficult to make identifications if they have people that you work with, you know, in kitchens have a lot of times they burn off their fingerprints to taking things out of the oven, not intentionally. Nurses historically have very poor quality fingerprints. Fishermen tend to take a lot of hooks in the fingers, so they also have. And so that some of the times you have amputations where the fingers are missing, so you are not able to collect an image. And so the palm print gives you more area to get that identification. But I can check with my fingerprint team to give you more specifics on the more technical reasons.
Thank you. I do have some more technical questions. So it on page 3, it goes on page 4, and it requires someone to notify Alaska State Trooper Post or Municipal Police Department located nearest to where the sex offender or child kidnapper resides. So in Alaska, we have, I imagine it would be hard for people to register in person to get close. So is a VPSO office considered a trooper post?
To the chair, for those individuals that are residing in areas where there's not a local municipal police department or a local trooper post, we will work with that registrant, so they will actually mail in their registration forms to the Sex Offender Registration Office, and the registry then becomes the registering office, and the postmark that is on the letter that is mailed verifying that the person is in Alaska, and we take the date of the postmark as their registration date, and that's how we're generally handling those that are living in the more rural communities.
So how do you, for reading through all of the notification, especially if they're going to be traveling out of state, they have to do that within a very short amount of time. How does that work on just really proper notification when it's going through the mail system?
Through the chair, that's something we work to educate the registrants about, those requirements, and certainly with this new timeline on the requirements. They're very aware of those requirements when it comes to registration, because they have to register within that 30-day period for their monthly registration. And so they're very cognizant of making sure that those things are at least postmarked by that timeline. And for the registrants that for the 7-day requirement for some of the lower 48 travel, that information, we would take that, again, the postmark on the form if they weren't able to come in person, because that's Alaska is unique because of our geographical challenges. The federal requirement is that they need to require to register in person, and that is just not geographically feasible for the registrants we have in Alaska because the registry is in Anchorage. And to require a registrant to come to Anchorage to do that, or to even to a local trooper post or the local police department, is just not economically feasible. So so that's why we're using the postmark on the form, the registration form that they're mailing in. And we would use that same thing. The registrant wouldn't be penalized as long as the postmark was registered within that time frame for the requirements.
Okay. It's almost one of those instances where there's a lot of meaning behind the words that are in statute, but our statutes need to say what we mean. And this may be one of those instances. The other question that I had was, Mr. Skidmore mentioned about kidnappers and mentioned that even this registry, if I heard correctly, includes adults who were kidnapped. But did I hear that correctly, that, or is it just child kidnappers who would have to register?
Through the chair, to the best of my knowledge, it is child kidnappers. But I would defer to Mr. Skidmore on the legal requirements. I don't have my statute book in front of me. So,
Mr. Skidmore, did I hear you accurately that it is not just child kidnappers?
Madam Chair, the statute of kidnapping applies to adults as well, but as I'm reading the sex offender registry statute, it does specify child kidnappers. So it may be that kidnappers of adult victims need not register, only child kidnappers.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. And that was my overall question of human trafficking, and if we were to want to include that, would that include the traditional napper who is trying to kidnap an adult who's not a kid without the added requirement that human trafficking is causing them to engage in forced labor? So there's a nuance there that I want to make sure if we were to amend this and go that route, that we're not missing the intent. But that's a deeper policy decision that I think we would need to consider if we were to make any changes. And Ms. Purinton, as this is deliberated, I want to know what could be implemented and any associated cost. I know you don't have an answer for that today, but this is something that I've been thinking about with this bill. Representative Gray, since we're on that thought, I'll let you do that, and then I want to circle back around to the paperwork question with Ms. Parnton. So, Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe this is for Mr. Skidmore. As we're talking about child kidnapping versus adult kidnapping, to me, I think of child kidnapping as being often in custody disputes where one parent is supposed to return a child and they don't, or they leave the state with the child without permission. And so I guess what I'm learning is that those folks need to register with the child, with a sex offender, if you're in that custody dispute and you take your child without permission. Is there another type of child kidnapping, or is that all one child kidnapping?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, there are actually two other crimes in Alaska called custodial interference. There's the second degree and there's a first degree. And the custodial interference tends to be the charges that are filed when there is a custody dispute and one parent is trying to take the child. Kidnapping itself has more onerous requirements than simply taking the kid when it's a parent. And in fact, if you were to look at kidnapping itself, which is Alaska Statute 1141-300, subsection B, it's an affirmative defense that the defendant was a relative of the victim. The victim was a child under the age of 18 or an incompetent person, and the primary intent of the defendant was to assume the custody of the victim. So that's, again, kidnapping is sort of excluded from those custodial interference situations, and there are two other statutes that address it, and so those folks do not end up on the registry.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm trying to distinguish, make sure we have a clear line in the law between a guardian or custodian of a child who is, as you say, you know, trying to assume custody of the child and probably shouldn't end up on a child trafficking or child kidnapping registry, versus a someone who has custody of a child who unfortunately is you know, engaged in trying to traffic the child or you know, transfer the child to a trafficker or something like that, in which case they probably should, in my view, end up, you know, on some kind of registry, or at least, you know, be guilty of a crime there. Is that line clear in law currently and in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe the answer to that question is yes. Custodial interference in the second degree is Alaska Statute 1141.330, and that one actually talks about when a relative is trying to assume the custody of a child, and that's a Class A misdemeanor. Custodial interference in the first degree, which is Alaska Statute 1141.320, talks about when taking that child or incompetent person, in the child or the incompetent person is being removed from state, which is what elevates it to a felony. But kidnapping is different than those things. And then if you want to throw in human trafficking or sex trafficking, if the adult who is the guardian or the parent of the child is causing the child to engage in forced labor as found in the human trafficking statutes or in sex trafficking, then in those circumstances, they could be charged with those crimes. But there's the elements to these various crimes are different and distinct. And I would tell you that I do believe there are clear lines between them. I don't know if you have a more specific question than that or not.
Paul? And can you just speak a little bit more to the situation where a parent or guardian or custodian is engaged in trafficking and is using the child that is under their care to do that in some way or other? How do we account for that situation where maybe they shouldn't, you know, be given special consideration for being custodian, at least to you know, prevent them from being registered, that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, both sex trafficking in the first degree and human trafficking in the first degree, as it's described in House Bill 68, have provisions in the first degree where the trafficker is the parent or the legal guardian of the child. Both of those then qualify as that greater offense. I would have to go back in current law, but I believe that there are similar provisions in current law right now for sex trafficking and human trafficking as well, so that there is a specific subsection where it says the person engaging in the trafficking is either the parent or the guardian, and that's the way that it's addressed.
Thank you. Looking on page six, line six of the bill, and there's a requirement to notify the department in writing if the sex offender or child kidnapper is away from the address provided, and they have to be away from that for 7 days or more. But I don't see, you know, any kind of deadline in there for when they're required to make that notification. How is that interpreted legally? Are they in violation of the law on a given time, date and time, and can be prosecuted? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm going to start by deferring to Ms. Purrington, and then I'll let you know if I have anything to add after she's given her explanation of how the Department of Public Safety approaches that notification requirement.
For the record, Lisa Purinton, to the chair, through the chair to Representative Eastman's question, the notification requirements are the 7 days. We would treat that just like we do currently for registration requirements. So if a person is released from custody, from Department of Corrections custody, they have a certain timeline where they have to register with our office. If they move to Alaska, there's a certain timeline that they're required to register with our office by. And this we would treat the same way, is when they are away from their home for the 7 days, we would, once they notify us, they would have to notify us within that, prior to them actually leaving their residency for more than 7 days. That's when we would look at that timeline for when they were non-compliant with their registration requirements.
Thank you, Paula.
Paula?
And in a previous hearing, I had asked dealing with subsection G above, which is talking about travel outside the state or travel outside the country. And there was reference to wanting to notify other jurisdictions about someone coming into their jurisdiction. I'm wondering, does that ever happen, or does that happen consistently where the state would receive this notice and then would proactively take steps to notify another jurisdiction that a child kidnapper, for example, is entering their jurisdiction?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, yes, we currently use a couple different means at the Sex Offender Registration Office to notify other states, and similarly we receive notifications from other states. The primary one is using the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act portal that is maintained by the Department of Justice. That portal is used by all the sex offender registries in the lower 48, plus Alaska and Hawaii and the territories. And when we receive notification that a sex offender is anticipated to be moving out of state to another state, then we set a notification into that portal to let that other state know that, you know, sex offender John Doe is moving to, well, we use a specific name, but we let them know that that registrant is scheduled to appear in that other state. We also let them know when they've left Alaska and when they've let us know when they anticipate being in that other state so that they can register. For the international travel, that's more on the federal requirement with the U.S. Marshals, because the U.S. Marshals are required to enforce the Megan's Law, which international Megan's Law has to do with notifying other countries when registered sex offenders are anticipated to be traveling in those countries. They also work with the State Department because there's notifications that need to be placed on that sex offender's passport to indicate that they are a registered sex offender, and that's part of the notification why there's a longer time frame for the international notice because of the broader notification process for those.
Paula? And specifically looking at this section here, Section 6 of the bill, what is the penalty if someone is out of compliance?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman's question, the penalty is a fail to register as a sex offender. That's a charge that the state or the federal government can pursue. The U.S. Marshal usually takes up the federal charges for fail to register. I'm not sure what the penalty is at the federal level. And I believe I will defer to Mr. Skidmore on the penalty at the state level. I believe it's a misdemeanor, but I'm not 100% on that.
Thank you. Follow up to him.
For the record, John Skidmore, through the chair to Representative Eastman, the penalty for a failure to register for a first time is a Class A misdemeanor, but subsequent violations then become a Class C felony.
And one of the things that was raised in the previous hearing was this 21-day requirement to provide written notice of any intended travel outside the United States, which I think we had concluded would include someone traveling to Anchorage, you know, by car to visit a relative in the hospital or for whatever reason. 21 days seems like more notice than you might have if you have a relative who's in the hospital or trying to catch somebody who's, you know, at the end of their life. Is there you know, any exception somewhere else in statute for those kind of situations where someone is just trying to travel from one part of the state to the other part, but they have to, you know, cross a border to do it by car?
For me?
For either, yes.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Eastman, the 21-day requirement is we would refer those to the U.S. Marshals Office because that would be for a question of compliance with the International Megan's Law. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly be a question for the Department of Law and for law enforcement, but generally because that requirement is specific for to meet the requirements for International Megan's Law, we would defer to U.S. Marshals and look at that as a federal charge versus looking at a state charge. So I don't know if the Department of Law would take a case with, such as that for that, or if they would defer these all to the federal government for those charges. I think that might be a case-by-case basis, but I'll certainly defer to Mr. Skidmore.
Mr. Skidmore?
For the record, John Skidmore, through the chair to Representative Eastman, I think that Ms. Purrington is accurate in that. Could we charge someone for not providing that information 21 days before they traveled? Yes, now with this provision under state law, we could certainly file charges under state law. However, it could also be filed under federal law. But in terms of the enforcement of those things, I would tell you that Ms. Burrington is absolutely correct. We would evaluate those on a case-by-case basis for the facts of what had occurred in those instances. We'd be looking at prior history of an offender for compliance, and we'd be having a discussion with our colleagues and partners in the U.S. Attorney's Office to determine where such prosecution would be most appropriate.
Thank you. To the chair, I've got more questions on jurisdiction, but I've been going a while. I'd like to let somebody else have a bite at the apple.
No, I'm enjoying these questions. Representative, wow, Mr. Skidmore just keeps getting promoted lately. Last week he was a senator, today he's a representative. Mr. Skidmore.
Promoting to senator is a compliment. Sorry, but that would be a politician.
Either way.
Yeah.
Would you remind us the underlying reason that that the changes to the or additions to the sex offender registry is in this bill and what the impetus for this was?
Yes, through the chair or to the chair. The changes that are made here are really for two primary reasons. One, as I think you've heard Ms. Purrington talk about, these types of details are more consistent with what the federal government requires and with what other states require. And trying to bring our registry closer in compliance with those others is one of the primary drivers. For example, the additional notifications of when someone's going to travel outside of state or outside of the country, without those requirements in state statute, someone's not required to provide that information to us, but then the United States cannot comply with its requirements under Megan's law, a federal law, about notifying other countries. The second rationale for it, though, is if you look at the concepts themselves, I'll take you, for example, to page 4 of our bill, HB 67. And if you look at lines 6 through 10, right now, it requires a sex offender or child kidnapper to provide their name, but not necessarily their full name. And having prosecuted for over 25 years in Alaska, I can tell you that there are a number of individuals with very similar names. Having a full name is an important component to make sure that there is not misidentification or any confusion there. Mailing and physical address as opposed to simply an address is important because, again, having prosecuted for 25 years in Alaska and having lived all around the state, I'm very familiar with the idea that many people have a physical address and a post office box, two very different places, and yet both are needed. The mailing address is needed to be able to contact the individual through the mail, but the physical address is needed if law enforcement needed to contact a person at the residence, or more precisely, for the public to know what is the physical location, the physical address where someone is located at. You then look at some of the other details on there. You have a school address if the person's in school. You have a telephone number used by the sex offender or child kidnapper, as opposed to just the phone number for the home. We're looking for the numbers that are used by them, so that that captures cell phones and things of the such. That's a more modern version of what this law should be describing. Social security numbers, passport information, citizenship status, all of these are the types of details that, again, are needed both for ensuring that we have the right person and some of these other identification numbers, as well as for some of that international type of travel that can occur. You then get to physical address for employment as opposed to just a place of employment. You could say that you work and pick any large company that's got multiple offices around the state. I don't want to pick on any one company, but just think of a business that has multiple locations. And so if you simply say that name, but that particular employer has offices or stores all over the state, that doesn't really tell you where that person is working. And so you really need to know the physical address of the employment. And the name of the employer and the job title are important things to help assess what's the type of conduct that the person is engaging in, and if law enforcement needs to get in touch with them quickly, provides them that sort of information. So that's just a quick sample of just those additional details and why they're helpful to us and why they are being pursued in this bill.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is to Mr. Skidmore. I thought I heard earlier that a passport was marked or identified as a sexual offender. Did I hear that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I was not describing that, but I did hear Ms. Purrington describe that. And so if you have further details or questions about that, she may be better suited to answer than I am.
Thank you. And this may be a question no one can answer. I mean, I know you can't get into Canada, Madam Chair, with a DWI, and that's through a database that they pick up on the passport. Is a sex offender entered into that database, and can you even travel to Canada or through Canada with a sex offense as a sexual registered?
To the chair, to Representative Johnson's question, the first question on the passport, yes, the State Department does mark a registered sex offender's passport with an indicator to indicate that they are a registered sex offender. And the travel to Canada, the database, the sex offender registration records are entered into state and federal databases, the same databases that are often used to enter criminal history records, such as the driving under the influence records that you mentioned. And the Canadian authorities would have access to both of those databases for that information. Whether the registered sex offender would be allowed access through Canada, that would be a question for the Canadian authorities to determine. I don't have that information, I'm afraid.
I find it would be amazing that if you can't get into Canada with a DWI, but you can get into Canada as a registered sex offender, I would be astounded. So I wanted, you know, so the driving through Canada part may be kind of a moot point that we've heard about. So I just wanted to kind of bring that up.
Co-Chair Howard. Thank you. And through the chair, when we're talking about being able to go through Canada, is there, just chalk it up to me being naive, but probation, is that, how many years is a probation? Does it depend on the crime, or is this, as a sex offender, is it longer than normal for other criminals or other crimes?
Through the chair to Representative Allard's question, the probation is just going to be dependent on what's in the statutory authority within the sentencing range for the particular offense that they're convicted of. I don't know that because sex offenses are considered more of the serious felony cases, oftentimes they will generally have a longer sentencing period just because of the nature of the severity of the crime. I don't know that it's specific because they're a sex offender, other than it's almost chicken and the egg kind of thing, because they're the serious felonies that they're convicted of oftentimes.
And so to kind of go off what Representative Johnson, and I might have missed it, was saying, do we have some sort of alert when folks are trying to fly out of our state? when they're sex offenders? I see a nod. Can you just repeat that if it's been already said?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I don't know that there's alerts like with the Transportation Security TSA. I'm sure what the acronym stands for at the moment right now. Just drew a blank.
Maybe I'm looking at if they're still on probation. Because, I mean, if they're not, I guess they could leave the state technically.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Allard, oftentimes as a condition of probation, there are travel restrictions while the person is on active Department of Correction custody supervision.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say, per Google, Canada refuses entry to anyone with a felony conviction, period.
Thank you.
That'd be nice. Duly noted. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I was going to switch subjects, so I'll wait if this is continuing.
I have a couple more, and then back to you. And it may be jumping the tracks a little bit. It's having to do with the sex registry. I had someone mention to me about a tiered, if I'm remembering the proper term, a tiered approach to, on the registry. Are you familiar with that? I hear Arizona has that. And is that something that Alaska has considered? Would you describe what that is for the committee? I see you nodding that you understand where I'm going. Just provide us information and if that is something that the department has considered moving to.
To the chair, great question on that. The Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, which is commonly referred to as SORNA, this is the federal requirements we've been talking about on making some of these changes on here. And part of the SORNA requirements is to have a tiering process where sex offenders are classified into a range of tier 1, 2, or 3 to determine the severity of the offense and assigning an equally comparable registration time period depending on the offense. Alaska currently does not have a tiering process officially, but we meet the requirements because of the minimum registration period under SORNA would be 10 years, and our minimum requirement is 15 years. So we exceed the minimum for those tiering standards, and the maximum, of course, is a lifetime registration requirement. So we only have 2 tiers, if you want to think of it that way. We have a 15-year requirement and then a lifetime requirement, and those are the only 2. We do not have the lesser 10-year requirement that is some states have through the tier process under SORNA.
Would you describe what that interface looks like for public safety and other departments who would be looking at the registry and the public, and how that interface would work with the tiers?
Through the chair, or to the chair, the sex offender registration website that the department maintains, it lists the individual's duration for the registration period. So it is very apparent to the public how long that individual has to register. It will list their conviction date, and then it will list the duration of their registration. The information from other states, because of the way we are currently assessing the out-of-state registrants, when they come to Alaska, they are usually fit into either the 15-year registration requirement or the lifetime registration requirement. We are not adopting to the other states' tiering at this point, unless their conviction was after 2019, because that's where it comes under compliance with HB 49, where if you have to register in another state, you have to register in the state of Alaska. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.
You did. Is the reason that Alaska has not just fully adopted this multi-tier approach is because of cost of implementation? Is there a larger reason why we haven't moved beyond just the 2 tiers?
To the chair, it's not been, I assume, the will of the legislature. We don't have the statutory requirements for the 3 tiers right now. The current process that we have in state law is for the 15 years or for lifetime registration. But certainly that can be changed if it's the will of the legislature.
So would you remind me again what the three tiers are?
The tier one is 15 years with 10 years of a clean record is where that we were talking about the 10 years in there for tier one. Tier two is the 25-year retirement registration requirement. And then tier three is the lifetime registration requirement. And it lists under each tier, which are considered the, as you go up from tier one, which is kind of, I don't want to say it's the least impactful sex offense. It's pretty much any sex offense that doesn't fall under tier two, which is the 25 years, or tier three, which is the lifetime registration. The lifetime registration is going to be the more severe offenses, and it includes the attempts or conspiracy to commit them. And these are usually going to be aggravated sex offenses as defined under federal law, or abusive sexual contact, again, as defined under federal law. And it's usually applied against a minor that's under 13 years of age. It also involves kidnapping of a minor, unless committed by a parent or guardian. And that's kind of your tier three is what they're considering the more serious of the sex offenses. And tier two would be middle ground, and then tier three would be anything that doesn't fit into either of those two, but it's still considered registrable by the nature of the conviction as being defined as a sexual offense.
Thank you. Would you be able to provide just a written assessment of, I'd like to know what the pros and cons of adopting the tiered approach would be, including a potential fiscal impact of what it would cost. Just trying to look at the bigger picture of what might be a good policy or not moving forward. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You had mentioned, Mr. Skidmore, through the chair, you had mentioned the importance of having an individual's full name for tracking purposes. Now, it would occur to me that the state might be really interested in the full name because they can track, you know, who's been convicted, who's not, but it doesn't necessarily help the public that much to have somebody's full name if they don't actually go by their full name. Does the department, you know, bring charges against someone who goes by another name, either nickname or some other name than the one that they're currently registered under?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it is not a crime for someone to be called by a name other than their given name or their legal name. So there is not a charge that we could file against them for that conduct.
Now, when you go to the Department of Public Safety webpage and you want to look into an individual who is registered, there is a category for aliases used. Are you saying that it's kind of optional that they fill out that information?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I would defer to Ms. Purrington about how they use that alias provision.
Well, Ms. Skidmore first. But the department doesn't enforce, but the Department of Law doesn't, you know, charge anyone for that. So I guess there's no legal enforcement, at least from the Department of Law.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, when you start to talk about the use of aliases, I believe that that actually is required to be reported. If you look in our bill on page 4, line 20, you'll note that one of the things that folks are required to present are all aliases used. What's displayed to the public or sort of what name they're going by, you would have to, before you're filing charges, you would be getting to the point of, okay, is this an alias? Is this something that the person regularly goes by? Is this a nickname that somebody else gave them? So there's other factual aspects to that that we would have to evaluate as to whether or not we could file charges. But in terms of how the Department of Public Safety explains aliases to offenders and what they require to provide, again, I would defer to Ms. Burrington on that.
Follow up. Okay. Now, just to make sure I understand what you were saying a minute ago accurately, but if someone fails to provide the alias that they go by, and let's just assume for a minute that they go by it, it's not something that somebody else, you know, gave them on, you know, on the fly. But if they fail to provide those aliases, does the department bring charges against those types of individuals?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, because the aliases are required, that does appear to then qualify for someone failing to provide the information that's necessary to register as a sex offender. And so the answer to your question is yes, they can be prosecuted for that.
And could you please provide the committee with, you know, how many instances the department has brought those charges? Because I'd love some specific information on that.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I apologize. I don't have statistics in front of me today, but if you're interested in statistics, I can probably tell you how many charges for failing to register are filed. I doubt that I could tell you how many are based on aliases, because that would require a different type of data that is not going to be captured for the cases that we automatically file. In other words, our statistics will tell me how many times have we filed charges for failure to register. It's not going to tell me within that failing to register which one of these enumerated things they failed to provide, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, or I, as you see them on pages 4 and 5 of the bill. That would require a review of each and every file going through it in that manner. So I don't have those sorts of statistics that I'm afraid that I can be able to provide you. But if you're interested in the total number of offenses, that I could probably provide you within the week.
Count me interested. Thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions on the sex registry? Representative Eason.
Thank you, through the chair. Do we have any kind of minimum age at which these requirements kick in to if someone was convicted in another state, you know, I understand there's convictions going at, in at lower and younger ages. Is there a cutoff if someone was convicted at age 4 or 5 of one of these offenses? Do they get caught up in this as well?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, in Alaska, we don't require individuals to register when they have an adjudication as a juvenile. We only require registration when someone is convicted in adult court. With the statute that requires you to register, if you have to register in another state, I can only tell you if they're required to register in that other state, then we would require to register them here. I'm unaware of any cases in which somebody is as young as 4 is required to register, but I don't know the practices of all other 49 states.
Thank you, Paula. Now, you had mentioned earlier about, you know, someone being, you know, found guilty of illegally trying to remove someone from the state. Can you speak to the jurisdictional issue there? You know, they're legal as long as they're in the state, but once they have crossed the lines and they're in the other state, now they've broken the law, but they've broken an Alaska state law, but they've done so in another state, which normally would be outside of our jurisdiction. Can you help us understand how that works?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think you're talking about custodial interference. Custodial interference in the second degree is a crime if the person takes custody of a child that they are not legally supposed to have custody of. And it becomes a custodial interference in the first degree if they remove the child from the state. Jurisdiction is about where the crime occurred. Well, the crime occurred here in Alaska because they took the child in Alaska and then left Alaska. And what would happen in those circumstances is we would be pursuing a governor's warrant. If we determined which state they had fled to, we would then take our warrant, provide it to their state. Our governor is essentially asking their governor to have that person extradited, and there are compacts between the states. Generally, then that other person would be returned back to the state of Alaska, and we would be able to prosecute them here in Alaska for the conduct that they had engaged in while in our jurisdiction.
Follow up. Thank you, the chair. Now, the applicability of this section of the bill, which we find on page 13 of the bill. I'm specifically looking at subsection B, which talks about these requirements applying to for the duty to register sex offender or child kidnapper for offenses committed before, on, or after the effective date of this act. And I'm curious if someone, you know, committed a crime and there were requirements for registration at the time that they committed the offense, and now we are increasing those requirements, it seems, or at least it could be argued, that someone's receiving a penalty that did not exist at the time that they committed the offense. How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there are multiple subsections within the applicability that are talking about the registration. Can you tell me which subsection specifically you're referring to so I can help answer your question?
Let's start at subsection B, because this is subsection B applies okay. to offenses that were committed before this bill actually goes into law.
So if you give me just one moment, I'm looking at subsection B. This one is talking about the requirements in 1263.101 subsection G. Subsection G is the provision that talks about providing notice when leaving the state. So there are not additional requirements, i.e. it's not saying you have to give additional information or you're punished for, let me rephrase that, you're not being punished for failing to give us information in the past. This would be saying for offenses that are committed even prior to the date of the enactment, going forward now, that person would be required to tell us if they're going to be leaving state. That's not additional punishment. That's not new punishment. And so it does not violate the ex post facto laws.
May I follow up? And I see there's some other sections that are also impacted by this retroactivity, provisions of the bill. Section H, I know, is also on that list. How do we understand the application of ex post facto in this situation? In that we're asking for, well, we're demanding, you know, at the threat of additional offenses, if someone doesn't provide new information or new information in a particular timing and so forth that previously they weren't required to provide, I guess the first question, you know, is there any ex post facto concerns? It seems like there isn't. Can you just articulate why there isn't in some of these other situations as well?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, both sections G and H deal with the notice and those travel requirements. And so they are both applying to conduct that has not yet occurred. So you've done something in the past that got you placed on the registry, but now in terms of what you have to do while you're on the registry, there's an additional requirement going forward. So ex post facto would be if they had failed to provide information about where they were going to travel prior to this law being enacted, and then we wanted to punish them for not having provided that information when there had never been a requirement for them to provide the information at the time they failed to provide it. That's different than going forward, you're required to provide it in the future. And now in the future, if you fail to provide it, you've been placed on notice that there is a requirement to provide it. And when you fail to do that, you can be held accountable for that. Ex post facto is really about after the fact. That's really what it's referring to. And so long as you were not punishing prior conduct, then you are not in violation of ex post facto. So that's why the provisions in H and G work, because it talks about an offense committed before, on, or after that caused them to be on the registry, but it's not the conduct that they're going to be engaging in the future that would be getting them in trouble. I hope that makes it clearer.
Thank you very much.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know if there are that the changes brought forward in this bill are in any way tied to a federal regulation change or requirement or a federal law requirement.
through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the bills as far as the changes that we're requesting to the sex offender registration data elements that we'll be collecting is in response to SORNA, which is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. That law has been in effect for a while, and we are penalized every year that we fail to comply with those requirements. And so this is to address and to come into compliance, into closer compliance with these requirements.
Follow up? What does the penalty look like? What are we avoiding?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the penalties right now are to the federal grants that we receive. In particular, there's one, it's the Byrne Justice Assistance Grant called the Byrne JAG Grant, and that is a 10% penalty for failing to comply with the requirements for SORNA.
I was wondering why we hadn't adopted these. It seems like they would have been common sense things, but obviously if things get neglected in the legislature. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a follow-up to Representative Carpenter's question. 10% of what?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, the 10% is usually anywhere from 700,000 upwards to $1 million each year in this grant funding. The grant funding is a formula grant, and so it is usually based on the state's crime statistics, where they will determine how much each state is eligible to apply for. So it varies from year to year.
Just to be clear, so we are losing out on $750,000 to $1 million, or 10% of $1 million and 10% of $750,000?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, it's 10% of that is the penalty that we're losing. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just remember what my other question was. In page 5 on line 9, with the registry, it says allow Alaska State Troopers, Department of Corrections, Municipal Police, and the addition is or any peace officer to take a complete set of the sex offender's fingerprints and palm prints. So any peace officer, does that include village peace officers, VPSOs, or VPOs, I mean?
To the chair, to the best of my knowledge, it does include that definition of peace officers, because it's anyone with the authority, even limited authority, for arrest powers, which the VPSOs would have, yes.
And does that include the VPOs?
To the best of my knowledge, yes. If they have the authority to make arrests, then it would include them as well. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question is for Mr. Skidmore. You were talking about registration and other requirements for sex offenders, child kidnappers. We talked about possibly including sex trafficking, perpetrators as well. Why don't we just do this for murder as well? What's the rationale for limiting it to sex offense and child kidnapping, for example?
Through the chair, Representative Beastman, for the record, this is John Skidmore. The registry was originally designed to alert both the public to the presence of individuals who the public deemed were a danger to their kids or to themselves, and sex offenders and child kidnappers were seen as the type of folks where that sort of information was needed. But it also is to provide law enforcement with information about folks that are in either of those categories, and that's to provide additional leads if you have a child go missing or a person go missing or a sexual assault or some other sex crime that occurs in a particular location. It's the type of thing that law enforcement can do to look at to say, are there additional leads for this type of conduct for people in the area that may be more prone to commit that type of conduct. I don't know that that analysis or that rationale would apply with equal force to individuals that are convicted for homicide crimes. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'd like to follow up on a question that you just asked regarding the any peace officer addition to the bill here, page 5, line 9. And you'd asked about VPOs. So I guess the question that I would ask is, since we're by name labeling or calling out state troopers, Department of Corrections officers, or municipal police, what is the purpose for adding or any peace officer to this bill?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I would like to qualify this statement on the village police officers. I would like to just double check that, because I'm not 100% on the village police officers. But when we're talking about any peace officer, if you think of, you know, municipal police, there's a couple exceptions right off the bat that don't fall into scope with that. The university police department is not a state trooper, or direct Department of Corrections or municipal police. So those are excluded. So we wanted to make sure those were included. Same thing with the Department of Transportation. You don't think of them of having a police force. But when you think of the Anchorage International Airport or the Fairbanks International Airport, those do have their own police departments as well. So we wanted to make sure that that was all inclusive. And that's why that it was included for any peace officers. And back to the chair's question originally for the village police officers, I will double check that and get back with you, because I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
So just to be perfectly clear, federal officers who have arrest powers don't need or do need a statute such as this in state law to allow them to take palm prints.
To the chair, to Representative Carpenter, I am not 100% on that. I can certainly check with U.S. Marshals. They are the ones that head the federal task force for sex offenders here in Alaska, and so I will work with their office to get that answer for you on the federal police officers.
If I may.
Mr. Skidmore?
Yes, John Skidmore, for the record. To answer your question through the chair, Representative Carpenter, a federal law enforcement officer does not need authorization under state statute to collect a palm print. Federal officers have their power derived from federal law, and if there is a federal law that allows them to collect a palm print, then they can certainly do so. They could then share it with state law enforcement officers, but federal law enforcement officers are not exercising any authority from state law. It all comes from federal law.
Thank you.
This question is either for Mr. Skidmore or Ms. Burnton. Do all peace officers have powers of arrest?
This is John Skidmore for the record. The answer is yes.
Okay. Just wanting to make sure that we're fully understanding this inclusion in the bill. I'm taking a look here to see if we have I think there's one other area, Mr. Skidmore, that I'd like you to address on page 10 that we haven't discussed yet in detail. And if you could go over, I believe you've covered section 9, but if you could talk about section 10 and the addition there, that would be helpful for us.
Very well, Madam Chair. Give me just one moment. Turning to page 10, and are you referring to section 10 on page 10, Madam Chair?
Yes, this was to assist in the evaluation and investigation of reports.
Mm-hmm.
It's speaking to occurring between children under 13 years of age. If you could go over this section. You may have talked about this at the first introduction of the bill, but if you could remind the members of what this involves.
Absolutely. John Skidmore for the record. Section 10 on page 10 of HB 67 is talking about Alaska Statute 4714-300 subsection A. That's the statute in the subsection in Alaska statutes that authorize the creation of what are referred to as CACs, or Child Advocacy Centers. Also, those are multidisciplinary child protection teams, which is what you see referenced on line 14 of page 10. And what it's saying here is that a CAC, or that Child Advocacy Center, has the authority to engage in interviews with kids that are victims in certain cases. And what you see added on line 17 through 19 is to assist in the evaluation and investigation of reports of sexual contact and sexual penetration as defined by Alaska Statute 81900 occurring between children under 13 years of age. What this does is it expressly authorizes that multidisciplinary team, law enforcement, medical, advocates, sort of the social workers, that multidisciplinary team that comes together can then be contacting and evaluating both the offender and the victim who is under the age of 13 when both are under the age of 13 and those two children have engaged in sexual contact or sexual penetration. The concept here is not to be prosecuting someone under the age of 13 to have engaged in that conduct, but rather to have the professionals and that multidisciplinary team interview and evaluate those children to determine what services they may need because they are engaging in behavior that is not normal or typical for children under the age of 13. And it's up to those professionals to then decide what sort of follow-up treatment or referrals should occur for those children. And this is just allowing those CAC teams to engage in that evaluation to begin.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these circumstances where the children have already been removed from their parents' custody, or this is the beginning conversations when a situation has been brought to their attention and the parents still have custody of their children?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, this provision does not require the child either to have been removed or to have not been removed. This is authorizing those individuals to be involved in those circumstances, regardless of the child custody status.
I guess a follow-up question to that, Madam Chair, would be what is the law speaking to the parent's role in an assessment of what needs to happen to the children, or is the law specifically saying that in a circumstances described where two 13-year-olds are engaged in sexual behavior, the state is going to decide what needs to happen?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the law is not saying that the state decides it. It is saying that this team is making an assessment and then would be making recommendations about what should be occurring. If the child is still in the custody of the parents, obviously the parents are deciding what services they're going to be providing to their own child. If the failure to provide those services rose to the level that it caused state officials and the courts to say this child is in need of aid and the failure to provide these services is the sort of thing that would have an impact on child custody, then I suppose that could be evaluated, but that's not the intent of it. This is not to say the child should be taken away from the parent or should not be taken away from the parent. That's not the purpose of this particular provision. This provision is simply saying you want a multidisciplinary team authorized to speak with the children and to conduct the assessment. Whether or not a child or a situation qualifies for further legal actions for a child in need of aid or some child custody matter is a whole separate analysis that I'm afraid I am not the right person to ask those questions about. Those would be other folks that practice in that area. But this provision is not taking away parental rights, adding parental rights. This is not talking about taking custody of the child or returning custody of a child. This is simply saying for that multidisciplinary team, they have the authority to be able to talk with the kids and then make an evaluation and make recommendations thereafter. Who decides whether or not they have to follow through with that will depend upon the custody status of that child.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I haven't, in all fairness and transparency here, I haven't read through the entire statute, AS 47.14.300. So I'm just looking at what's written in front of me here, but the statute as presented in the bill says that the purpose of a team, and that's the Child Advocacy Center team, and I understand that multidisciplinary child protection team, is to assist in the evaluation and investigation of reports of child abuse or neglect as defined by statute. And then below what we're trying to add into the bill, or add into the statute here in the bill, it says, and to provide consultation and coordination for agencies involved in child in need of aid cases. So you've got what's currently in statute is abuse and neglect and child in aid in need. And what we're adding in there is sexual contact between minors. That, I guess, doesn't fall in abuse or neglect or child in aid of need, but is going to be on par with both of those two situations. Do I understand the situation correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I'm assuming that's a question for me. John Skidmore, for the record, the concept again is to say that the multidisciplinary team can help evaluate the kids to try and get the appropriate services for the kids. They make recommendations. But it's the custody, who has custody of the kid, will determine whether or not they obtain those services. If you're asking me, does this place conduct of this nature, that is sexual contact or penetration between two kids under the age of 13, does that place it on par with other things? I would tell you that in those circumstances, what the experts have told us, and I'm not the expert here, so if there are other questions, then I would want to defer to those folks, unfortunately, who are not here today. But what the experts have described to us is that when you have children under the age of 13 engaging in that type of behavior, that is worthy of assessing, is there something else going on? Because it can, it's not always, but can be the scenario in which if you do have children engaging in that type of behavior, there may be something else going on at home or in some other place that's led children to engage in that type of behavior, which does get to the issues of, is this child in a good, I don't want to say setting because I don't think that's the right word, but if there are other issues in that child's life that need to be evaluated for additional care for the child. In other words, typically children don't engage in this behavior under the age of 13 unless someone has been showing them this type of conduct or causing children to think about this type of conduct. They don't automatically go there themselves. There's got to be something else typically that leads them to that type of behavior, and I think that's what they're trying to assess.
I think so. I don't know that I have a question. It's more of a statement, and I think I can hold it till later. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Well, I have a very specific instance that has been brought to me in my district where children under 13, there is one child who was assaulted by another in the reading circle that that we could very much quantify as rape. And they're, according to the family's understanding, very little was done on behalf of this circumstance. And Mr. Skidmore, is this the type of situation that this additional language is seeking to address? And would that fall under the definition of child abuse? Can child abuse be come from another child?
To the chair, it's a two-part question. I'm going to take the first part first, which is this amendment designed to address the scenario that you describe? I believe that this amendment is designed to allow the multidisciplinary team to engage for that type of conduct to try and help provide guidance and make recommendations. Would this qualify as child abuse? One child engaging in the conduct with another, I don't know that that would qualify as child abuse, but I think the child abuse that they are attempting to look at is what was causing the child to engage in the aggressive behavior. What was it that triggered or caused that child to do that to begin with? Because that does lend itself to the possibility, not to the actual conclusion of, but to the possibility that needs to be investigated. Is there something else in that child, the aggressive child's life, that's causing them to then engage in that aggressive behavior? Because if there is something there, that could be child abuse. But you don't know without being able to investigate these things, and you can't make those types of evaluations without having the multidisciplinary team be able to engage with that 13 or that under 13-year-old child to begin with.
So with the investigation of the reports and these recommendations from this child protection team, would these recommendations typically be required by the courts in if there was cases brought forward, would these be a court requirement for the parties involved?
Madam Chair, you are getting out of my area of expertise, but what I can tell you is that the recommendations that the multidisciplinary team make could be the type of thing that a court could require if there's an appropriate case brought to the courts and the courts had jurisdiction, then yes, the courts could order someone to follow through with those recommendations. But the court itself, I don't think makes the order for the child to go to the child protection team. The statute is what authorizes that to happen. I hope I've answered your question there.
So without this provision, what's the current practice with the child protection team per statute? I know that the child protection team isn't your area, but per statute, what is happening now in these cases?
To the chair, right now in those circumstances, the team is not able to engage because it is their feeling that this statute doesn't authorize them to engage in those instances without this language. That's why they're the ones, the organizations that represent or deal with these child advocacy centers are the ones that came to us and requested this particular provision, and that's why it's been added there.
Representative Gray.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I'll follow up on your question. So I believe the chair just asked what happens, and what we're hearing is that without this provision, then this child advocacy team cannot engage. So do these children just get interviewed by the police officer?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I can't tell you in every circumstance what would happen. It may not be that officers are attempting to engage in that interview. It's going to depend upon the facts of the case. But the challenge is that if the officer attempts to engage in the interview, we would hope the officer would be trained in how to interview children of that age. But one of the primary reasons we have child advocacy centers is because folks that work there are trained to interview children, are trained for those types of interactions, and they provide professionals from the various disciplines coming together at one single instance to all provide their expertise and knowledge together, which is a better scenario than just a single officer trying to do it on their own, assuming that the officer would, in fact, engage in that particular interview.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, what are the typical ways that these types of cases are being brought to law enforcement's attention? Are these kids getting discovered at school? I'm just curious about how these cases are being brought forward.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I understand your question, and I'm afraid we've now really gone far beyond what I'm comfortable answering, because my experience as a prosecutor is really dealing more with the adult cases. And once you start to get into those specific details, I would tell you these are the types of questions that are best directed towards professionals that deal with those types of cases. Because I don't see them, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to how those cases typically get brought forward.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a question concerning the language that we're amending in and the following section one, just to make sure that we have continuity here. Is there continuity when we're talking about ensuring that there are trained investigators? If the trained investigators need to be trained in child abuse and neglect, do they also need to be trained in sexual contact occurring between children under 13 years of age? Because we're adding that specific purpose in, but the language below just says that the training is tied to the child abuse and neglect above. Is there an additional training requirement that would be needed if we added that in?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I don't believe the answer to that question is yes. In other words, I think it's fine as is. And I predominantly say that again because the organization that brought this to our attention is one that deals with these child advocacy teams that is made up of the same sort of membership that sits on those child advocacy teams. And I would tell you that the people that sit on the teams are already trained in this type of behavior so that they are the ones best suited to be interacting with the children about it.
Follow up.
In which organization would that be, sir?
Through the chair, give me just one second. I have the acronym in my head, but I know you guys dislike acronyms, so I want to make sure I'm saying it correctly. I believe it's the Alaska. It's an A. I'm sorry. Give me just one moment.
Sir, I retired out of the military. I like acronyms. But it will be helpful to define it.
Yeah, there's one called the Alaska Children's Alliance, but that's not the one that brought it forward. This is the, sorry, it's on the tip of my tongue. I think it's the Children's Justice Task Force, if I have it correct.
Thank you.
And we may have to invite them in. I think this is something that we care deeply about and want to make sure that we have an understanding of this and the impacts. And I know that this has been a question on what we can do by mothers in my district. So we have a question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair, for Mr. Skidmore. I still remember the front page news when it was discovered that two teenage boys had kidnapped, I think it was a five-year-old from a department store, and then murdered the child. And while I'm sure it was headlined because it doesn't happen very often, these types of crimes do happen, and sometimes there's teenagers involved as perpetrators. Who in the state is trained and prepared to handle cases where you have a young teen that is or suspected of being a perpetrator of one of these violent crimes?
through the chair to Representative Eastman, in the scenario that you're describing to me, those teens, I believe, were not under the age of 13. I believe they were over the age of 13, and that was a child advocacy center that would be involved in interviewing the victims. And then for the age of the perpetrator, what really matters is whether or not it ends up being handled by the Division of Juvenile Justice, which certainly has training for some of those things, or whether or not that's the case that ends up moving into adult court. And that's dependent upon the age of the perpetrator and the type of crime that's been committed. And then from there, it's the sanctions that get imposed then also dictate the type of treatment or the types of sanctions that are applied to the perpetrators. I hope that's responsive to your question.
In the case where the department is going to or is anticipating charging a minor as an adult, who would we normally expect to be responsible for the interviewing and that sort of thing for a young suspect of violent crime, like a 12 or 13-year-old?
To the chair, Representative Eastman, I have never in my 25-year career seen a child of the age of 12 or 13 charged as an adult. The cutoff age for an automatic waiver into adult court is if the child is 16 through 18. There can be petitions filed when the child offender is under the age of 16, but I've only seen such petitions pursued when the children are 14 or 15 years of age. Once you get down lower than that, we don't pursue petitions, and quite frankly, in the last decade, even for the petitions filed for children 14 and 15, typically the courts have not granted those petitions.
Oh. And since the department doesn't normally and probably wouldn't anticipate pursuing those type of charges for a young perpetrator like that, how is that case handled? So you have a 12-year-old that is suspected of killing someone. They're not going to be tried as an adult. How is that handled? You know, who would take over the investigation and so forth?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, when you have a child that is under the age of 15, law enforcement certainly can be conducting interviews, but the ultimate determination of what happens with that child is one that would be managed by the Division of Juvenile Justice. They have different criteria than do the adult courts in terms of assessing what's appropriate for those types of children. In terms of the sanctions that would be imposed, and they may have additional options, legal procedures that they can follow in terms of how those cases are handled. Again, our department typically does not handle juvenile justice matters unless it's going to an adjudication, which otherwise would be like a trial. We would conduct the trial, but absent the actual trial occurring, all of those issues are managed by the Division of Juvenile Justice, and I would refer you to them for other specific details of what they would be doing. Thank you.
Any further questions on Section 10? Okay, we have, I think we've done a good in-depth analysis of this up to this point. Now that we've cracked open this area concerning children, I definitely will be looking further into that. That concludes our business for today. Thank you, Ms. Perrington, Mr. Skidmore, for making yourself available. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Wednesday, March 29th at 1 p.m. to hear House Bill 98, State Ownership of Submerged Land, by Representative Sadler in its first hearing. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It's 2:49 p.m.